life against his will, he soon found he felt comfortable there. However, it was at times difficult to withhold his expert opinion on certain subjects and to play the beginner in a role he was disquietingly born to. Even the nurses were condescending to the nurses' aides, and Homer was irritated to see that the doctors were condescending to everyone, most of all to their patients. Candy and Homer were not allowed to give shots or medication, but they had more to do than make beds, empty bedpans, give back rubs and baths, and run those errands of friendliness that gave the modern hospital such a constant scuff of feet. They were given delivery room duties, for example. Homer was unimpressed with the obstetrical procedure he witnessed. It could not hold a candle to Dr. Larch's work, and in some cases it could not hold a candle to his own. If Dr. Larch had often criticized Homer for his heavy touch with ether, Homer could not imagine how the old man would react to the heavy-handedness that was applied to that inhalation at Cape Kenneth Hospital. In St. Cloud's, Homer had seen many patients who were so lightly etherized that they could converse throughout their own operations. In Cape Kenneth's recovery rooms, the patients struggling to emerge from their ether doses looked bludgeoned. They snored, gap-mouthed, with their hands hanging deadweight and the muscles in their cheeks so slack that at times their eyes were pulled half open. It especially angered Homer to see how they dosed the children, as if the doctors or the anesthesiologists were so uninformed that they didn't pause to consider the patient's body weight. One day he sat with Candy on either side of a 5-year-old boy who was recovering from a tonsillectomy. That was the nurse's aide work. You sat with the patients coming out of ether, especially the children, especially the tonsillectomies. They were often frightened and in pain and nauseous when they woke. Homer claimed they wouldn't be nearly so nauseous if they'd been given a little less ether. One of the nurses was in the recovery room with them. It was the one they liked. A young, homely girl about their age. Her name was Caroline, and she was nice to the patients and tough to the doctors. "You know a lot about ether, Homer," Nurse Caroline said. "It seems overused to me in certain cases," Homer mumbled. "Hospitals aren't perfect, they're just expected to be," Nurse Caroline said. "And doctors aren't perfect either, they just think they are." "Right," said Homer Wells. The 5-year-old's throat was very sore when he finally woke up, and he went on retching for quite some time before any ice cream would slide down his throat and stay down. One of the things the nurse's aides did was to be sure that the children, in such condition, didn't choke on their own vomit. Homer explained to Candy that it was very important that the child, in a semi-etherized state, not aspirate or inhale any fluid such as vomit into the lungs. "Aspirate," Nurse Caroline said. "Was your father a doctor, Homer?" "Not exactly," said Homer Wells. It was Nurse Caroline who introduced Homer to young Dr. Harlow, who was in the throes of growing out his bangs. A colic persisted in making his forehead look meager. A floppy shelf of straw-colored hair gave Dr. Harlow's eyes the constant anxiousness of someone peering from under the brim of a hat. "Oh, yes, Wells, our ether expert," Dr. Harlow said snidely. "I grew up in an orphanage," said Homer Wells. "I did a lot of helping out around the hospital." "But surely you never administered any ether," said Dr. Harlow. "Surely not," lied Homer Wells. As Dr. Larch had discovered with the Board of Trustees, it was especially gratifying to lie to unlikable people. "Don't show off," Candy told Homer when they were driving back to Hartshaven together. "It doesn't become you, and it could get your Dr. Larch in trouble."
"When did I show off?" Homer asked.
"You really haven't yet," Candy said. "Just don't, okay?" Homer sulked. "And don't sulk," Candy told him. "That doesn't become you either."
"I'm just waiting and seeing," said Homer Wells. "You know how that is." He let her out at the lobster pound. He usually came in with her and chatted with Ray. But Homer was mistaken to confuse Candy's irritability either with coldness toward him or with anything but the profoundest confusion of her own. She slammed the door and walked around to his side of the van before he could drive away. She indicated he should roll down his window. Then she leaned inside and kissed him on the mouth, She yanked his hair, hard, with both hands tilting his head back, and then she bit him quite sharply in the throat. She banged her head on the window frame when she pulled herself back from him. Her eyes were watery, but no tears spilled to her face.
"Do you think I'm having a good time?" she asked him. "Do you think I'm teasing you? Do you think I know whether I want you or Wally?"
He drove back to Cape Kenneth Hospital. He needed work more substantial than mousing. It was the goddamn mousing season again. How he hated handling the poison. He arrived simultaneously with a sailor slashed up in a knife fight. It had happened where Ray worked, in Kittery Navy Yard, and the sailor's buddies had driven him around in a makeshift tourniquet, running out of gas coupons and getting lost on the way to several hospitals much nearer to the scene of the fight than the one in Cape Kenneth. The gash, into the fleshy web between the sailor's thumb and forefinger, extended nearly to the sailor's wrist. Homer helped Nurse Caroline wash the wound with ordinary white soap and sterile water. Homer could not help himself. He was accustomed to speaking to Nurse Angela and to Nurse Edna in the voice of an authority. "Take his blood pressure opposite arm," he said to Nurse Caroline, "and put the blood pressure cuff on over a bandage. To protect the skin," he added, because Nurse Caroline was staring at him curiously. "The cuff might have to be on there for a half an hour or more," said Homer Wells. "I think I can give instructions to Nurse Caroline, if you don't mind," Dr. Harlow said to Homer. Both the doctor and his nurse stared at Homer Wells as if they had witnessed an ordinary animal touched with divine powers, as if they half expected Homer to pass his hand over the profusely bleeding sailor and stop the flow of blood as quickly as the tourniquet stopped it.
"Very neat job, Wells," Dr. Harlow said.
Homer observed the injection of the 0.5% procaine into the wound and the subsequent probing of Dr. Harlow. "The knife had entered on the palmar side of the hand," observed Homer Wells. He remembered his grays, and he remembered the movie he had seen with Deborah Pettigrew, the cavalry officer with the arrow in his hand, the arrow that fortunately missed the branch of the median nerve that goes to the muscles of the thumb. He watched the sailor move his thumb. Dr. Harlow was looking.
"That's a rather important branch of the median nerve," Dr. Harlow said slowly to the cut-up sailor. "You're lucky if that's not cut."
"The knife missed it," said Homer Wells.
"Yes, it did," said Dr. Harlow, looking up from the wound.
"How do you know?" he asked Homer Wells, who held up the thumb of his right hand and wiggled it.
"Not only an ether expert, I see," said Dr. Harlow, still snidely. "Knows all about muscles, too."
"Just about that one," said Homer Wells. "I used to read Gray's Anatomy. For fun," he added.
"For fun?" said Dr. Harlow. "I suppose you know all about blood vessels, then. Why not tell me where all this blood is coming from?"
Homer Wells felt Nurse Caroline brush his hand with her hip. It was surely sympathetic contact. Nurse Caroline didn't care for Dr. Harlow either. Despite Candy's certain disapproval, Homer couldn't help himself.
"The blood vessel is a branch of the palmar arch," he said.
"Very good," said Dr. Harlow, disappointed.
"And what would you recommend I do about it?"
"Tie it," said Homer Wells, "3-ochromic."
"Precisely," said Dr. Harlow. "You didn't get that from Gray's."
He pointed out to Homer Wells that the knife had also cut the tendons of the flexor digitorum profundus and the flexor digitorum sublimus.
"And where might they go?"
he asked Homer Wells.
"To the index finger," Homer said. "Is it necessary to repair both tendons?" asked Dr. Harlow.
"I don't know," said Homer Wells. "I don't know a lot about tendons," he added.
"How surprising," said Dr. Harlow. "It is only necessary to repair the profundus," he explained.
"I'm going to use 2-0 silk. I'll need something finer to bring the edges of the tendon together."
4-0 silk, recommended Homer Wells.
"Very good," said Dr. Harlow.
"And something to close the palmar fascia?"
3-ochromic, said Homer Wells.
"This boy knows his stitches,"
Dr. Harlow said to Nurse Caroline, who was staring intently at Homer Wells.
"Close the skin with 4-0 silk," Homer said. "Then I'd recommend a pressure dressing on the palm. You'll want to curve the fingers a little bit around the dressing."
That's called the position of function, Dr. Harlow said.
I don't know what it's called, Homer said.
Were you ever in medical school, Wells? Dr. Harlow asked him.
Not exactly, said Homer Wells.
Do you plan to go? Dr. Harlow asked.
It's not likely, Homer said. He tried to leave the operating room then, but Dr. Harlow called after him.
Why aren't you in the service? He called.
I've got a heart problem, Homer said.
I don't suppose you know what it's called, said Dr. Harlow.
Right, said Homer Wells.
He might have found out about his pulmonary valve stenosis on the spot, if he had only asked. He might have had an X-ray and an expert reading. He could have learned the truth. But who seeks the truth from unlikable sources?
He went and read some stories to the tonsillectomy patients. They were all dumb stories. Children's books didn't impress Homer Wells.
But the tonsillectomy patients were not likely to be around long enough to hear David Copperfield or Great Expectations.
Nurse Caroline asked him if he would give a bath and a back rub to the large man recovering from the prostate operation.
"Don't ever underestimate the pleasure of pissing," the big man told Homer Wells.
"No, sir," Homer said, rubbing the mountain of flesh until the big man shone a healthy pink. Olive was not home when Homer returned to Ocean View. It was her time for plane spotting. They used what was called the yacht-watching tower at the Haven Club, but Homer didn't think any planes had been spotted. All the men spotters, most of them seniors' former drinking companions, had the silhouettes of the enemy planes tacked on their lockers. The women brought the silhouettes home and stuck them on places like the refrigerator door. Olive was a plane spotter for 2 hours every day. Homer studied the silhouettes that Olive had on the refrigerator.
I could learn all those, he was thinking. And I can learn everything there is to know about apple farming.
But what he already knew, he knew, was near-perfect obstetrical procedure and the far easier procedure, the one that was against the rules.
He thought about rules. That sailor with the slashed hand had not been in a knife fight that was according to anyone's rules. In a fight with Mr. Rose, there would be Mr. Rose's own rules, whatever they were. A knife fight with Mr. Rose would be like being pecked to death by a small bird, thought Homer Wells. Mr. Rose was an artist. He would just take the tip of a nose, just a button or a nipple. The real cider house rules were Mr. Rose's. And what were the rules at St. Cloud's? What were Larch's rules? Which rules did Dr. Larch observe? Which ones did he break or replace? And with what confidence? Clearly Candy was observing some rules, but whose? And did Wally know what the rules were? And Melanie? Did Melanie obey any rules? Wondered Homer Wells.
Look, said Lorna, there's a war, have you noticed?
So what, said Melanie.
Because he's probably in it, that's so what, Lorna said, because he either enlisted or he's going to get drafted.
Melanie shook her head. I can't see him in a war, not him. He just doesn't belong there.
For Christ's sake, Lorna said, you think everyone in a war belongs there?
If he goes, then he'll come back, Melanie said. The ice on the Kennebec in December was not secure. It was a tidal river, it was brackish, and there was open water, gray and choppy, in the middle. But not even Melanie could throw a beer bottle as far as the middle of that river in Bath. Her bottle, bouncing off the creaky ice, made a hollow sound, and rolled toward the open water it couldn't reach. It disturbed a gull, who got up and walked a short way along the ice, like an old woman holding up a number of cumbersome petticoats above a puddle.
"Not everyone's coming back from this war, that's all I'm saying," Lorna replied.
Wally had trouble coming back from Texas. There were a series of delays and bad weather. The landing field was closed. When Homer and Candy picked him up in Boston, the first thing he told them was that he had only 48 hours. He was still happy, however. "He was still Wally," Candy would say later, and especially pleased that he'd received his commission.
"Second Lieutenant Worthington," Wally announced to Olive. Everyone cried, even Ray. With the gas rationing, they couldn't manage the usual driving around and around.
Homer wondered when Wally would want to be alone with Candy and how they would manage it. Surely he wants to manage it, Homer thought. Does she want to, too? He wondered. For Christmas Eve, everyone was together, and Christmas Day there was nowhere to go. Olive was home, and Ray wasn't building torpedoes or pulling lobster traps. And the day after Christmas, Candy and Homer would have to take Wally back to Boston. Oh, Candy and Wally did plenty of hugging and kissing. Everyone could see that. On Christmas night, in Wally's bedroom, Homer realized that he'd been so glad to see Wally that he'd forgotten to notice very much about his second Christmas away from St. Cloud's. He also realized he'd forgotten to send Dr. Larch anything, not even a Christmas card. "I've got more flying school to get through," Wally was saying, "but I think it's going to be India for me." "India," said Homer Wells. "The Burma run," said Wally. "To go from India to China, you got to go over Burma. The Japs are in Burma." Homer Wells had studied the maps at Cape Kenneth High. He knew that Burma was mountains, that Burma was jungles. When they shot your plane down, there would be quite a wide range of possible things to land on. "How are things with Candy?" Homer asked. "Great," Wally said. "Well, I'll see you tomorrow," he added. Ray went early to build the torpedoes, and Homer observed that Wally left Ocean View at about the same time Ray would be leaving for a kittery. Homer spent the early morning being of little comfort to Olive. 48 hours is not what I'd call coming home," she said. "He hasn't been here for a year. Does he call this a proper visit? Does the Army call it a proper visit?" Candy and Wally came to pick up Homer before noon. Homer imagined that they had managed it. But how does one know such things, short of asking? "Do you want me to drive?" Homer asked. He had the window seat, and Candy sat between them. "Why?" Wally asked. "Maybe you want to hold hands," Homer said. Candy looked at him. "We've already held hands," Wally said, laughing, "but thank you anyway." Candy did not look amused, Homer thought. "So, you've done it, you mean?" Homer Wells asked them both. Candy stared straight ahead, and Wally didn't laugh this time. "What's that, old boy?" he asked. "I said, so you've done it." "Had sex, I mean," said Homer Wells. "Jesus, Homer," said Wally, "that's a fine thing to ask." "Yes, we've done it. Had sex," Candy said, still looking straight ahead. "I hope you were careful," Homer said to both of them. "I hope you took some precautions." "Jesus, Homer," Wally said. "Yes, we were careful," Candy said. Now she stared at him, her look as neutral as possible. "Well, I'm glad you were careful," Homer said, speaking directly to Candy. "You should be careful, having sex with someone who's about to fly over Burma." "Burma?" Candy turned to Wally. "You didn't say where you were going," she said. "Is it Burma?" "I don't know where I'm going," Wally said irritably. "Jesus, Homer, what's the matter with you?" "I love you both," said Homer Wells. "If I love you, I've got a right to ask anything I want. I've got a right to know anything I want to know." It was, as they say in Maine, a real conversation stopper. They rode almost all the way to Boston in silence, except that Wally said, trying to be funny, "I don't know about you, Homer. You're becoming very philosophical." It was a rough goodbye. "I love you both, too, you know," Wally said in parting. "I know you do," Homer said. On the way home, Candy said to Homer Wells, "I wouldn't say philosophical. I would say eccentric. You're becoming very eccentric, in my opinion. And you don't have a right to know everything about me, whether you love me or not." "All you've got to know is, do you really love him?" Homer said. "Do you love Wally?" "I've grown up loving Wally," Candy said. "I've always loved Wally and always will." "Fine," said Homer. "That's all there is to it, then." "But I don't even know Wally anymore," Candy said. "I know you better, and I love you, too." Homer Wells sighed.
So we're in for more waiting and seeing, he thought. His feelings were hurt. Wally hadn't once asked him about his heart. What would he have answered anyway? Wilbur Larch, who knew that there was absolutely nothing wrong with Homer's heart, wondered where Homer's heart was. Not in St. Cloud's, he feared. And Wally went to Victorville, California, advanced flying school. U.S. Army Air Forces, that is what his stationery said. Wally spent several months in Victorville, all the pruning months, as Homer Wells would remember them. Shortly after apple blossom time, when Ira Titcomb's bees had spread their marvelous life energies through the orchards of Ocean View, Wally was sent to India. The Japanese held Mandalay. Wally dropped his first bombs on the railroad bridge in Mytke. Tracks and the embankment of the south approach were badly smashed, and the south span of the bridge was destroyed. All aircraft and crews returned safely. Wally also dropped his bombs on the industrial area of Myingyan, but heavy clouds prevented adequate observation of the destruction. In that summer, when Homer Wells was painting the cider house white again, Wally bombed the jetty at Akyab and the Shweli Bridge in northern Burma. Later, he hit the railroad yards at Prome. He contributed to the 10 tons of bombs that were dropped on the railroad yards at Shwebo, and to the fires that were left burning in the warehouses at Kolin and Tan Buzayat. The most spectacular hits he would remember were in the oil fields in Yenanjat. The sight of those oil derricks ablaze would stay with Wally on his return flight, across the jungles, across the mountains. All aircraft and crews returned safely. They made him a captain and gave him what he called easy work. "Always be suspicious of easy work," Dr. Wilbur Larch once said to Homer Wells. Wally had won the best name for a plane competition at Fort Meade. Now he finally got to use it. He got to name his own plane. "Opportunity Knocks," he called it. The painted fist under the inscription looked very authoritative. It would later puzzle Candy and Homer Wells that the name was not Knox once, or twice, but just Knox. He flew the India-China route over the Himalayas, over Burma. He carried gasoline and bombs and artillery and rifles and ammunition and clothing and aircraft engines and spare parts and food to China. He brought military personnel back to India. It was a 7-hour round-trip flight, about 500 miles. For 6 of the hours he wore an oxygen mask. They had to fly so high. Over the mountains they flew high because of the mountains. Over the jungles they flew high because of the Japanese. The Himalayas have the most vicious air currents in the world. When he left Assam, the temperature was 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It was like Texas, Wally would think. They wore just their shirts and socks. The heavily loaded transports needed to climb to 15,000 feet in 35 minutes. That was when they reached the first mountain pass. At 9,000 feet, Wally put on his pants. At 14,000, he put on his fleece-lined suit. It was 20 degrees below zero up there. In the monsoon weather, they flew mostly on instrument. They called that aerial route the Lifeline. They called it flying over the hump. Here were the headlines on the 4th of July. "Yanks wreck rail bridge in Burma, Chinese rout chaps in Hubei province." Here was what Wally wrote to Candy and to Homer. Wally was getting lazy. He sent the same limerick to both. "There was a young man of Bombay who fashioned a cunt out of clay, but the heat of his prick turned it into a brick and chafed all his foreskin away." That summer of 1940-something, the public interest in keeping use of the shore lights to a minimum forced the temporary closing of the Cape Kenneth Drive-In Theater, which Homer Wells did not feel as a tragic loss. Since he would have had no choice but to attend the movies with Candy and Deborah Pettigrew, he was grateful to the war effort for sparing him that awkwardness. Mr. Rose informed Olive that he would be unable to provide a worthwhile picking crew for the harvest. "Considering the men who are gone," he wrote, "and the travel, I mean the gas rationing." "Then we've spruced up the cider house for nothing," Homer said to Olive. "Nothing is ever improved for nothing, Homer," she said. The Yankee justification for hard work in the summer months is both desperate and undone by the rare pleasure of that fleeting season. Homer Wells, nurse's aide and orchardman, was mowing in the rows between the trees when the news came to him. On a sweltering June day, he was driving the International Harvester, and he had his eye on the sickle bar. He didn't want to snag a stump or a fallen branch. For that reason, he didn't see the green van, which was trying to head him off. He almost ran into it. Because the tractor was running, and the mower blades too, he didn't hear what Candy was yelling when she jumped out of the van and ran to him. Olive was driving, her face a stone. "Shot down!" Candy was screaming, when Homer finally shut off the ignition. "He was shot down! Over Burma!" "Over Burma," said Homer Wells. He dismounted from the tractor and held the sobbing girl in his arms. The tractor was shut off, but the engine still knocked, and then shuddered, and then throbbed. Its heat made the air shimmer. Maybe, thought Homer Wells, the air is always shimmering over Burma. Chapter 9. Over Burma. 2 weeks after Wally's plane was shot down, Captain Worthington and the crew of Opportunity Knox were still listed as missing. A plane making the same run had noted that approximately 1 square mile of the Burmese jungle, roughly halfway between India and China, had been consumed by fire, presumably caused by the exploding plane. The cargo was identified as jeep engines, spare parts, and gasoline. There was no evidence of the crew. The jungle was dense in that area and believed to be unpopulated. A spokesman for the U.S. Army Air Forces paid a personal visit to Olive and told her that there was some reason to be optimistic. That the plane obviously had not exploded in the air meant that the crew might have had time to bail out. What would have happened afterward was anyone's guess. That would have been a better name for the plane, thought Homer Wells. Anyone's guess. But Homer was supportive of Olive and Candy's view that Wally was not dead, that he was just missing. Privately, Homer and Ray Kendall agreed that there wasn't much hope for Wally. "Just suppose he didn't go down with the plane," Ray said to Homer when they were pulling lobster pots. "So then he's in the middle of the jungle. And what does he do there? He can't let the Japs find him, and there's got to be Japs around. They shot down the plane, didn't they?" "There could be natives," said Homer Wells. "Friendly Burmese villagers," he suggested. "Or nobody at all," Ray Kendall said. "Some tigers and lots of snakes," he added. "Ah, shit. He should have been in a submarine." "If your friend survived all the rest," wrote Wilbur Larch to Homer Wells, "he's got all the diseases of Asia to worry about. Lots of diseases." It was horrible to imagine Wally suffering, and not even Homer's longing for Candy could allow him any comfort with the idea that Wally was already dead. In that case, Homer knew, Candy would always imagine that she loved Wally best. Reality for orphans is so often outdistanced by their ideals. If Homer wanted Candy, he wanted her ideally. In order for Candy to choose Homer, Wally had to be alive, and because Homer loved Wally, he also wanted Wally's blessing. Wouldn't any other way be compromising to them all? Wilbur Larch was flattered that Homer asked his advice, and on a matter of romantic love, of all things. "How should I behave with Candy?" Homer had asked. The old man was used to being such an authority that he found it natural to assume an authoritative voice. "Even regarding a subject he knows nothing about," Nurse Angela said to Nurse Edna indignantly. Larch was so proud of what he had written Homer that he showed his letter to his old nurses before sending it along. "Have you forgotten what life is like at St. Cloud's?" Dr. Larch asked Homer. "Have you drifted so far away from us that you find a life of compromise to be unacceptable? And you, an orphan, of all people, have you forgotten how to be of use? Don't think so badly of compromises. We don't always get to choose the ways we can be of use. You say you love her, then let her use you. It may not be the way you had in mind, but if you love her, you have to give her what she needs, and when she needs it, not necessarily when you think the time is right. And what can she give you of herself? Only what she has left. And if that's not everything you had in mind, whose fault is that?
Are you not going to accept her because she hasn't got 100% of herself to give? Some of her is over Burma. Are you going to reject the rest? Are you going to hold out for all or nothing? And do you call that being of use?"
"It's not very romantic," Nurse Angela said to Nurse Edna.
"When was Wilbur ever romantic?" Nurse Edna asked.
"Your advice is awfully utilitarian," Nurse Angela said to Dr. Larch.
"Well, I should hope so," Dr. Larch said, sealing the letter. Now Homer had a companion in sleeplessness. He and Candy preferred the night shift at Cape Kenneth Hospital. When there was a lull in their work, they were allowed to doze on the beds in the children's non-communicable ward. Homer found that the music of the restless children soothed him. Their troubles and pains familiar, their whimpers and outcries and night terrors transporting him beyond his own anxieties. And Candy felt that the drawn black curtains in the nighttime hospital were suitable for mourning. The prevailing blackout conditions, which she and Homer had to observe in driving to and from the hospital if it was after dark, were also to Candy's liking. They used Wally's Cadillac for these occasions. They were permitted to travel with only parking lights on, and the Cadillac's parking lights were the brightest. Even so, the dark coastal roads seemed barely lit. They drove at funeral speed. If the stationmaster at St. Cloud's, formerly the stationmaster's assistant, had ever seen them passing, he would have thought again that they were driving a white hearse. Meanie Hyde, whose wife Florence was expecting, told Homer that he was sure his new baby would share something of Wally's soul, if Wally was truly dead. And if Wally was alive, Meanie said, the appearance of the new baby would signify Wally's escape from Burma. Everett Taft told Homer that his wife Big Dot had been plagued by dreams that could only mean that Wally was struggling to communicate with Ocean View. Even Ray Kendall, dividing his underwater attention between his lobsters and his torpedoes, said that he was reading his lobster pots, by which he meant that he found the content of the traps hauled from the deep to be worthy of interpretation. Untouched bait was a special sign. If the lobsters, which prefer food that's truly dead, wouldn't take the bait, it must mean that the bait was manifesting a living spirit.
"And you know I ain't religious," Ray said to Homer.
"Right," Homer said. Because Homer Wells had spent many years wondering if his mother would ever return to claim him, if she even thought about him, if she was alive or dead, he was better at accepting Wally's undefined status than the rest of them were. An orphan understands what it means that someone important is just missing. Olive and Candy, mistaking Homer's composure for indifference, were occasionally short-tempered with him. "I'm only doing what we all have to do," he said, reserving special emphasis for Candy. "I'm just waiting and seeing." There were few fireworks that 4th of July. For one thing, they would have violated the blackout conditions. And for another, any simulation of bombs and gunfire would have been disrespectful to those among our boys who were facing the real music. In the nighttime hospital at Cape Kenneth, the nurses' aides conducted a quiet Independence Day celebration, which was interrupted by the hysterics of a woman who demanded an abortion from the young and imperious Dr. Harlow, who believed in obeying the law. "But there is a war," the woman countered. Her husband was dead. He'd been killed in the Pacific. She had the wire from the War Department to prove it. She was 19 and not quite 3 months pregnant.
"I'll be glad to speak with her again when she's behaving reasonably," Dr. Harlow told Nurse Caroline.
"Why should she behave reasonably?" Nurse Caroline asked him. Homer Wells had to trust his instincts regarding Nurse Caroline. Besides, she had told him and Candy that she was a socialist.
"And I'm not pretty," she added truthfully. "Therefore, I'm not interested in marriage. In my case, I'd be expected to appear grateful, or at least to consider myself lucky." The hysterical woman would not be calmed, perhaps because Nurse Caroline's heart wasn't in it.
"I'm not asking for anything secret," the woman shouted. "Why should I have to have this baby?"
Homer Wells found a piece of paper with columns for laboratory analysis. He wrote the following across the columns. "You go to St. Cloud's. You ask for the orphanage." He gave the piece of paper to Candy, who gave it to Nurse Caroline, who looked at it before she gave it to the woman, who instantly stopped protesting.
When the woman had gone, Nurse Caroline made Homer and Candy accompany her to the dispensary.
"I'll tell you what I usually do," Nurse Caroline said, as if she were furious with them. "I perform a perfectly safe dilatation without the curettage. I just dilate the cervix. I do this in my kitchen, and I'm very careful. They have to come to the hospital for a completion, of course. Someone might think they tried to do it themselves, but there's no infection and nothing's damaged. They've just miscarried. They've had the D without the C. All they need is a good scraping. And the bastards have to be accommodating. There's all the bleeding, and it's clear the woman's already lost it."
She paused and glared at Homer Wells.
"You're an expert about this, too, aren't you?"
"Right," said Homer.
"And do you know a better way than my way?" she asked.
"Not that much better," he said. "It's a complete D&C, and the doctor is a gentleman."
"A gentleman," Nurse Caroline said doubtfully. "What's the gentleman cost?"
"He's free," Homer said.
"I'm free, too," Nurse Caroline said.
"He asks you to make a donation to the orphanage if you can afford it," said Homer Wells.
"Why hasn't he been caught?" Nurse Caroline asked.
"I don't know," Homer said. "Maybe people are grateful."
"People are people," Nurse Caroline said in her socialist voice. "You took a stupid chance telling me, and a more stupid chance telling that woman. You don't even know her."
"Yes," Homer agreed.
"Your doctor isn't going to last if you keep that up," Nurse Caroline said.
"Right," Homer said. Dr. Harlow found them all in the dispensary. Only Candy looked guilty, and therefore he stared at her.
"What are these two experts telling you?" Dr. Harlow asked.
He spent a lot of time looking at Candy when he thought no one saw him, but Homer Wells saw him, and Nurse Caroline was very sensitive to the longings other women inspired. Candy was tongue-tied, which made her seem more guilty, and Dr. Harlow turned to Nurse Caroline.
"You got rid of the hysteric?" he asked her.
"No problem," Nurse Caroline said.
"I know that you disapprove," Dr. Harlow told her, "but rules exist for reasons."
"Rules exist for reasons," said Homer Wells, uncontrollably. It was such a stupid thing to say, he felt compelled to repeat it. Dr. Harlow stared at him.
"No doubt you're an abortion expert, too, Wells," Dr. Harlow said.
"It's not very hard to be an abortion expert," Homer Wells said. "It's a pretty easy thing to do."
"You think so?" Dr. Harlow asked, aggressively.
"Well, what do I know?" Homer Wells said, shrugging.
"Yes, what do you know?" Dr. Harlow said.
"Not much," Nurse Caroline said gruffly. Even Dr. Harlow appreciated this. Even Candy smiled. Homer Wells smiled sheepishly, too. "You see, I'm getting smarter." That is what he smiled to Nurse Caroline, who viewed him with an expression of condescension that was proper for nurses to exhibit only to nurses' aides. Dr. Harlow seemed to feel that the pecking order he revered was being treated with the reverence that was mandatory from them all. A kind of glaze appeared to coat his face, a texture composed of righteousness and adrenaline. Homer Wells gave himself a brief sensation of pleasure by imagining something that could wake up Dr. Harlow and humble him. Mr. Rose's knife work might have that effect on Dr. Harlow. Homer imagined Mr. Rose undressing Dr. Harlow with his knife. Every article of clothing would be gathered around the doctor's ankles, in strips and tatters, yet on the doctor's naked body there wouldn't be a scratch.
A month after Wally's plane was shot down, they heard from the crew of Opportunity Knox. "We were halfway to China," the co-pilot wrote, "when the Nips took some pot shots. Captain Worthington ordered the crew to bail out." The crew chief and the radio man jumped close together. The co-pilot jumped third. The roof of the jungle was so dense that when the first man crashed through it, he could not see the other parachutes. The jungle itself was so thick that the crew chief had to search for the others. It took him 7 hours to find the radio men. The rain was so heavy, it made such a din against the broad palm leaves, none of the men heard the plane explode. The atmosphere was so rich with its own scents that the smell of the burning gasoline and the smoke from the fire never reached them. They wondered if the plane had not miraculously recovered itself and flown on. When they looked up, they could not see through the treetops, which everywhere glittered with bright green pigeons. In 7 hours, the crew chief contacted 13 leeches of various sizes, which the radioman thoughtfully removed. The crew chief plucked 15 leeches off the radioman. They found that the best way to remove the leeches was to touch the lighted end of a cigarette to their posterior ends. That way they would release their contact with the flesh. If you just pulled them, they kept breaking. Their strong sucking mouths would remain attached. The radioman and the crew chief ate nothing for 5 days. When it rained, which it did most of the time, they drank the rainwater that gathered in puddles in the big palm leaves. They were afraid to drink the other water they encountered. In some of the water they thought they saw crocodiles. Because the radioman was afraid of snakes, the crew chief did not point out the snakes he saw. The crew chief was afraid of tigers, and he thought he saw one once, but the radioman maintained that they only heard a tiger, or several tigers, or the same tiger several times. The crew chief said that the same tiger followed them for 5 days. The leeches tired them out, they said. Although the roof of the jungle made the pelting rain louder, it did keep the rain from falling directly on the two men. Yet the jungle was so saturated that the rain almost constantly dripped on them, and when, for brief intervals, the rain stopped, the roof of the jungle allowed no sunlight to penetrate to the jungle floor, and the raucous birds, silent in the rain, were louder than the rain when they had their opportunities to protest the monsoon. The radioman and the crew chief had no idea where Wally and the co-pilot were. On the 5th day they met up with the co-pilot, who had reached a native village only a day ahead of them. He was quite badly drained by the leeches. Since he'd been traveling alone, he'd had no one to burn off the leeches he couldn't reach. In the middle of his back, there had been quite a gathering of them, which the natives were skillful at removing. They used a lighted stalk of bamboo, like a cigar. The natives were Burmese and friendly. Although they spoke no English, they made it clear that they had no fondness for the Japanese invasion, and also that they knew the way to China. But where was Wally? The co-pilot had landed in a grove of ironwood, and the canes of bamboo that he had had to hack his way through were as stout as a man's thigh. The edge of his machete was as dull and round as the back of the blade. The Burmese let them know they were not safe to stay and wait for Wally where they were. Some of the villagers would lead the co-pilot, the crew chief, and the radioman into China. For that trip, they darkened their skin with mashed people berries and tied orchids in their hair. They didn't want to look like white men. The trip took 20 days walking. They traveled 225 miles. They cooked no food. At the end of the journey, their rice was moldy. There was so much rain. The crew chief claimed he was terminally constipated. The co-pilot claimed he was dying of diarrhea. The radioman shat rabbit pellets and carried a low-grade fever for 15 of the 20 days. He grew a helmet of ringworm. Each man lost about 40 pounds. When they reached their base in China, they were hospitalized for a week. Then they were flown back to India, where the co-pilot was retained in the hospital for diagnosis and treatment of an amoeba. No one could say what amoeba it was. The crew chief had a colon problem. He was also retained. The radioman and his ringworm went back to work. "They took all our gear when they put us in the hospital in China," he wrote to Olive. "When they gave it back to us, it was all lumped together. There was 4 compasses. There was just 3 of us, but there was 4 compasses. One of us jumped out of the plane with Captain Worthington's compass." In the radioman's opinion, it was better to have crashed with the plane than to have landed in that part of Burma without a compass. In August of 1940-something, Burma officially declared war against Great Britain and the United States. Candy told Homer that she needed a new place to sit, to be left alone. The dock made her want to jump off. She'd sat too many times on that dock with Wally. It didn't help that Homer would sit there with her now. "I know a place," Homer told her. Maybe Olive was right, he thought. Maybe they hadn't cleaned the cider house for nothing. When it rained, Candy sat inside and listened to the drops on the tin roof. She wondered if the jungle sounded as loud as that, or louder, and if the sweet rot smell of the cider apples was anything like the stifling decay-in-progress smell of the jungle floor. When the weather was clear, Candy sat on the roof. Some nights she allowed Homer Wells to tell her stories there. Perhaps it was the absence of the Ferris wheel and of Mr. Rose's interpretations of the darkness that prompted Homer Wells to tell Candy everything. That summer, Wilbur Larch wrote to the Roosevelts again. He had written to them both so many times under the constellations of ether that he was unsure whether he had actually written to them or had only imagined doing it. He never wrote to one without writing to the other. He usually began, "Dear Mr. President" and "Dear Mrs. Roosevelt," but occasionally he felt more informal and began, "Dear Franklin Delano Roosevelt." Once he even began, "Dear Eleanor." That summer he addressed the President quite plainly. "Mr. Roosevelt," he wrote, dispensing with the endearment, "I know that you must be terribly busy with the war, yet I feel such confidence in your humanitarianism and in your commitment to the poor, to the forgotten, and especially to children." To Mrs. Roosevelt he wrote, "I know your husband must be very busy, but perhaps you could point out to him a matter of the utmost urgency, for it concerns the rights of women and the plight of the unwanted child." The confusing configurations of light that dazzled the dispensary ceiling contributed to the strident and incomprehensible manner of the letter. "These same people who tell us we must defend the lives of the unborn, they are the same people who seem not so interested in defending anyone but themselves after the accident of birth is complete. These same people who profess their love to the unborn's soul, they don't care to make much of a contribution to the poor, they don't care to offer much assistance to the unwanted or the oppressed. How do they justify such a concern for the fetus and such a lack of concern for unwanted and abused children? They condemn others for the accident of conception. They condemn the poor, as if the poor can help being poor. One way the poor could help themselves would be to be in control of the size of their families. I thought that freedom of choice was obviously democratic, was obviously American. You Roosevelts are national heroes. You are my heroes, anyway. How can you tolerate this country's anti-American, anti-democratic abortion laws?" By now, Dr. Larch had stopped writing and was ranting in the dispensary. Nurse Edna went to the dispensary door and rattled the frosted glass panels. "Is it a democratic society that condemns people to the accident of conception?" roared Wilbur Larch. "What are we, monkeys? If you expect people to be responsible for their children, you have to give them the right to choose whether or not to have children. What are people thinking of? You're not only crazy, you're ogres." Wilbur Larch was yelling so loudly that Nurse Edna went into the dispensary and shook him. "Wilbur, the children can hear you," she told him, "and the mothers, everyone can hear you." "No one hears me," said Dr. Larch. Nurse Edna recognized the involuntary twitching in Wilbur Larch's cheeks and the slackness in his lower lip. The doctor was just emerging from ether. "The President doesn't answer my letters," Larch complained to Nurse Edna. "He's very busy," Nurse Edna said. "He may not even get to read your letters." "What about Eleanor?" Wilbur Larch asked. "What about Eleanor?" Nurse Edna asked. "Doesn't she get to read her letters?" Wilbur Larch's tone of voice was whiny, like a child's, and Nurse Edna patted the back of his hand, which was spotted with brown freckles. "Mrs. Roosevelt is very busy, too," Nurse Edna said, "but I'm sure she'll get around to answering you." "It's been years," Dr. Larch said quietly, turning his face to the wall. Nurse Edna let him doze in that position for a while. She restrained herself from touching him. She was inclined to brush his hair back from his forehead, in the manner that she often soothed any number of the little ones. Were they all becoming children again? And were they, as Nurse Angela claimed, all becoming the same, all resembling each other, even physically? Anyone visiting St. Cloud's for the first time might suspect that they were all members of the same family. Suddenly Nurse Angela surprised her in the dispensary. "Well, are we out of it?" she asked Nurse Edna. "What's the trouble? I was sure I ordered a whole case." "A case of what?" Nurse Edna asked. "Methylate. Red," Nurse Angela said crossly. "I asked you to get me some red methylate. There's not a drop left in the delivery room."
"Oh, I forgot," said Nurse Edna, bursting into tears.
Wilbur Larch woke up. "I know how busy you both are," he said to the Roosevelts, although he gradually recognized Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela. Their tired arms held out to him. "My faithful friends," he said, as if he were addressing a vast audience of well-wishers. "My fellow laborers," said Wilbur Larch, as if he were running for re-election, a little tiredly but no less earnestly seeking the support of his companions, who also honored the Lord's work. Olive Worthington sat in Wally's room with the lights off. That way, if Homer looked into the house from the outside, he wouldn't see her sitting there. She knew that Homer and Candy were at the cider house, and she tried to tell herself that she did not resent the apparent comfort Homer could give to Candy. He was powerless to comfort Olive in the slightest. In truth, Homer's presence, given Wally's absence, irritated Olive, and it was a testimony to her strength of character that she was able to criticize herself for this irritation. Only rarely did she allow her irritation to show. And she would never have considered Candy unfaithful, not even if Candy had announced to everyone that she was giving Wally up and marrying Homer Wells. It was only that Olive knew Candy. Olive realized that Candy could not give up Wally without giving him up for dead, and Olive would have resented that. "He doesn't feel dead," Olive thought. "And it isn't Homer's fault that he is here and Wally is there," she reminded herself. A mosquito was in the room, and its needle-like whine so disturbed Olive that she forgot why she was keeping Wally's room in darkness. She turned on the lights to hunt for the mosquito. Wouldn't there be terrible mosquitoes where Wally was? The Burmese mosquitoes were speckled, and much larger than the main variety. Ray Kendall was also alone, but he was only mildly bothered by the mosquitoes. It was a still night, and Ray watched the silent heat lightning violate the blackout conditions along the coast. He was worried about Candy. Raymond Kendall knew how someone else's death could arrest your own life, and he regretted, in advance, how the forward motion of Candy's life might be halted by her losing Wally. "If it was me," Ray said aloud, "I'd take the other fella." The other fella, Ray knew, was more like Ray. It wasn't that Ray preferred Homer Wells to Wally. It was that Ray understood Homer better. Yet Ray did not disrupt a single snail while he sat on his dock. He knew that it took a snail too long to get where it was going. "Every time you throw a snail off the dock," Ray teased Homer Wells, "you're making someone start his whole life over." "Maybe I'm doing him a favor," said Homer Wells, the orphan. Ray had to admit that he liked that boy. The heat lightning was less spectacular from the cider house roof. The sea was not visible even in the brightest flashes. Yet the lightning was more disquieting there. Both its distance and its silence reminded Candy and Homer Wells of a war they could not feel or hear. For them, it was a war of far-off flashes. "I think he's alive," Candy said to Homer. When they sat together on the roof, they held hands. "I think he's dead," said Homer Wells. That was when they both saw the lights go on in Wally's room. That night in August, the trees were full, the boughs bent and heavy, and the apples, all but the bright waxy green Gravensteins, were a pale green going to pink. The grass in the rows between the trees was knee-high. There would be one more mowing before the harvest. That night, there was an owl hooting from the orchard called Cock Hill. Candy and Homer also heard a fox bark from the orchard called Frying Pan. "Foxes can climb trees," said Homer Wells. "No, they can't," Candy said. "Apple trees, anyway," Homer said. "Wally told me." "He's alive," Candy whispered. In the flash of heat lightning that illuminated her face, Homer saw her tears sparkle. Her face was wet and salty when he kissed her. It was a trembling, awkward proposition, kissing on the cider house roof. "I love you," said Homer Wells. "I love you too," Candy said. "But he's alive." "He isn't," Homer said. "I love him," Candy said. I know you do, said Homer Wells. I love him, too. Candy lowered her shoulder and put her head against Homer's chest so that he couldn't kiss her. He held her with one arm while his other hand strayed to her breast, where it stayed. This is so hard, she whispered, but she let his hand stay where it was. There were those distant flashes of light out to sea, and a warm breeze so faint it barely stirred the apple leaves or Candy's hair. Olive, in Wally's room, followed the mosquito from a lampshade, against which she was unable to strike it, to a spot on the white wall above Homer's bed. When she mashed the mosquito with the heel of her hand, the dime-sized spot of blood left on the wall surprised her. The filthy little creature had been gorging itself. Olive wet her index finger and dabbed at the blood spot, which only made the mess worse. Angry at herself, she got up from Homer's bed, unnecessarily smoothing his untouched pillow. She smoothed Wally's untouched pillow, too. Then she turned off the night table lamp. She paused in the doorway of the empty room to look things over, and turned off the overhead light. Homer Wells held Candy around her hips to help her off the roof. They must have known it was precarious to kiss on top of the cider house. It was more dangerous for them on the ground. They were standing together, arms loosely around each other's waists, his chin touching her forehead. She was shaking her head, no, no, but just a little, when they both became aware that the lights from Wally's room were out. They leaned against each other as they walked to the cider house, the tall grass clutching at their legs. They were careful not to let the screen door bang. Who could have heard it? They preferred the darkness. Because they did not reach for the light switch in the kitchen, they never came in contact with the cider house rules that were tacked next to it. Only the palest flashes of the heat lightning showed them the way to the sleeping quarters, where the twin rows of iron beds stood with their harsh springs exposed, the old mattresses rolled in army barracks fashion at the foot of each bed. They unrolled one. It was a bed that had held many transients. The history of the dreams encountered upon that bed was rich. The small moan that caught in the back of Candy's throat was soft and difficult to hear above the iron screeching of the bed's rusted springs. The moan was as delicate in that fermented air as the fluttery touch of Candy's hands, lighting like butterflies upon Homer's shoulders, before he felt her hands grip him hard, her fingers sinking in as she held him tight. The moan that escaped her then was sharper than the grinding bedsprings and nearly as loud as Homer's own sound. Oh, this boy whose crying had once been a legend upriver in Three Mile Falls. Oh, how he could sound. Olive Worthington, rigid in her bed, listened to what she thought was an owl on Cock Hill. What was it hooting about? She thought. She thought of anything that would distract her from her vision of the mosquitoes in the jungles of Burma. Mrs. Grogan lay wide awake, momentarily frightened for her soul. The good woman had absolutely nothing to fear. It was an owl, she heard. It made such a mournful sound. Wilbur Larch, who seemed always to be wide awake, passed his skillful, careful fingers across the keyboard of the typewriter in Nurse Angela's office. Oh, please, Mr. President, he wrote. Young Steerforth, who suffered allergies to dust and to mold, found the night oppressive. It seemed to him that he couldn't breathe. He was lazy about getting out of bed, and therefore blew his nose on his pillowcase. Nurse Edna rushed to him at the sound of such thick and troubled trumpeting. Although Steerforth's allergies were not severe, the last orphan who was allergic to dust and mold was Fuzzy Stone. You have done so much good already, Wilbur Larch wrote to Franklin D. Roosevelt, and your voice on the radio gives me hope. As a member of the medical profession, I am aware of the insidiousness of the disease you have personally triumphed over. After you, anyone who holds your office will be ashamed if he fails to serve the poor and the neglected, or should be ashamed. Ray Kendall, stretched out upon his dock as if the sea had cast him up there,
could not make himself get up, go inside, and go to bed. It was rare for the coastal air to be so torpid.